You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Our guest today is Brian Peck, a therapist and coach for religious trauma and recovery. Mr. Peck is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in religious-based trauma in his private practice, Room to Thrive, which he describes as a secular therapy for human well-being. He also helps guide individuals through their deconversions with evidence-based practices online. Mr. Peck believes it's possible to thrive after adverse religious experiences. As a therapist, he says, he helps survivors resolve their religious trauma with body-based therapy and resources. As a coach, he empowers people who have been harmed by religion to clarify their values and learn to trust themselves with trauma-informed coaching and resources. We asked him to join us today to learn more about his practice and what drew him to this work. Welcome, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome, welcome.
Brian, we often ask our guests this initial question. What, if you can describe it briefly, was your religious and spiritual journey from childhood to the present?
Yeah, so I think the first 4 or 5 years of my life, I was in a family without religion. My dad had backslidden, as the church would like to say, and there was a Easter Sunday morning, and I have some faint memories of that as a young child, where my dad went up to the front of the church and rededicated his life to Christ. And my mom, who was unchurched up until that point, realized that she needed to kind of follow suit to make this work. And so, yeah, that's when religion really entered my family in a major way. And I did, you know, Christian school K through 12, went 1 year of Bible college. Yeah, so that was definitely a big part of my life. We were part of the Conservative Holiness Movement, was the name of the church in the small kinds of denominations that were kind of a splinter off of Methodists, Free Methodists, and then Wesleyan Holiness, a lot of kind of small splinters that often happens inside of evangelicalism. And so there was a real focus on a second work of grace, which is kind of like Pentecostalism, but without the speaking in tongues. There was a dying to yourself and, you know, just really giving yourself, whole self to God. And so that was a real strong emphasis, a lot of viewing oneself as evil or depraved and in needing the Holy Spirit to kind of, you know, bring you back into the fold and to be acceptable to God again. And so, yeah, there was a lot of shame-based, fear-based approaches to religion, lots of camp meetings and revival services, lots of fear. Yeah, that was kind of my childhood, like I said, all the way through 1 year of Bible college before things began to fall apart for me. And after that 1 year of Bible college, I began attending Penn State part-time. I met secular folks who were decent humans, who had a lot of compassion and care for others. I was in a protest literature class and was surrounded by folks as we were, you know, kind of reading the you know, various books and pieces from folks who had been harmed by religion. And I realized that either I could be the compassionate human that I wanted to be, or I can maintain my beliefs as I had learned them, but I couldn't do both. And I chose to be a compassionate human. And that really kind of escalated my deconstruction or deconversion process.
So it sounds perhaps that the work you do now was a natural transition from your background and your collegiate life.
Yeah, it certainly is informed by that. I think a lot of folks who are in the helping professions are, to borrow an old term, you know, wounded healers, you know, folks who have had these kinds of experiences themselves or who have witnessed other folks suffering and wanting to do something about that. And so certainly that's a big piece of why I do what I do today.
So, Brian, Prepping for your interview sent me down so many rabbit holes. It was flipping fantastic, but also it gets me all like, you know, like running around in my head because there's so many things I would love to ask you about because I have a similar background. Like I was shaking my head and agreeing with a lot of the things that you were talking about because that's my own experience. My doctoral research, we kind of say it's research as me search. This is why it's like, oh, I can't wait to talk to him. So I don't know where to start, but here's where I'll start with my questioning. So I'm always interested in where people land on their language to describe this kind of experience, this kind of religion. You use the term adverse religious experiences. And so this may seem, you know, obvious, but why adverse and what does that cover?
Yeah. So, you know, this has been an ongoing process. So in kind of describing my experience in college, that's been more than 20 years ago. And so a lot of time has passed since then. And I've been thinking about this a lot, of course, supporting folks who are going through a deconstruction process or who have been harmed by religion. We're always looking for, you know, evidence-based approaches to that and better language. And so a few years ago, a colleague and I formed the Religious Trauma Institute. And we were connected to the Reclamation Collective, another group who are doing similar kinds of work. And we just noticed that the language around religious trauma, adverse religious experiences, it just wasn't quite capturing everyone's experience. It wasn't broad enough. It wasn't inclusive enough. It was quite narrow, focused on primarily evangelicals in the U.S. And their experience of leaving religion. And we recognize that folks have been harmed by religion who may have chosen to leave for their own well-being, and others who have chosen to stay in their faith of origin or to transition to another faith. And so we also recognize that religious trauma, most survivors, when we talk about trauma, will not see themselves in that language. That, you know, if you talk to a lot of survivors, this happens in therapy all the time, a person describing a really horrific experiences that they had. And when you say, well, that sounds like trauma, and they're like, well, no, that's just what it was like in my family, or that's just how it was in my church. And so trauma, often because, you know, we're still as a culture getting up to speed on what trauma is and how it impacts us, seems like it's too high of a bar for a lot of folks. If you weren't abused by a priest, then you didn't experience religious trauma. And so we wanted to come up with some better language, first for survivors so they can better identify their experiences inside of that, as well as to inform the research moving forward. And so I do have some definitions here. I'm happy to share with you what we have. So we're describing adverse religious experience as any experience of a religious belief, practice, or structure that undermines an individual's sense of safety or autonomy and or negatively impacts their physical, social, emotional, relational, spiritual, or psychological well-being. I know that's a mouthful. It's designed to be broad enough to encompass most people's experiences. And it's kind of also based on adverse childhood experiences and the studies and the research behind that, which has been so helpful. We're not saying that every adverse religious experience results in trauma in the same way that having an adverse childhood experience doesn't necessarily result in, you know, negative impacts the rest of your life. But if you begin to see two or three of those or four or five of those, we can, you know, normally predict that you'll have some negative impacts showing up in your life. And so we wanted to, you know, kind of think about this a bit differently, help folks, you know, explore these different categories and subcategories. And so we have an ongoing exploratory survey where folks can describe some of these adverse religious experiences to help us kind of gain a sense of like what are the kind of main categories and subcategories. And then from there we can, you know, as we share those with folks, they can notice like, well, I did experience this thing. And also over here in this other category, I didn't realize that was also part of my experience, and kind of give them a better sense of, you know, the various adverse experiences that they encountered in religion. And then to begin to explore, you know, how is that showing up in my life now? Is it impacting me now?
Well, and that that survey that you're talking about, you have that linked on your website, right? Didn't mm-hmm. I see that?
Anybody can
go in and participate.
I just wanted to follow up with a question about terminology and language that you use. You talk about religious trauma as being devastating. Devastating, it, to me, it just gets me right here in my heart. It's pain. How do you describe it in this context?
Yeah, again, wanting to find a more kind of encompassing language, something that's broad enough to capture folks' experience, but also narrow enough that we can, you know, focus research and treatment as well. And so we're defining religious trauma as the physical, emotional, or psychological response to religious beliefs, practices, or structures that is experienced by an individual as overwhelming or disruptive and has lasting adverse effects on a person's physical, mental, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being. And again, a fairly big mouthful there. What I want us to focus on, though, is the response to these adverse religious experiences that's experienced by an individual as overwhelming and disruptive. And as we think about trauma through that lens, you know, trauma has evolved, how we conceptualize trauma has evolved, you know, quite a bit over the past, you know, 40 or 50 years. You know, PTSD wasn't included in the DSM until 1980. And, you know, complex PTSD still isn't in the DSM. Thankfully, we're making some progress in that
area. Wow, I didn't know
so,
that.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. So it was included in the ICD-11, I think in 2017. And so it's being recognized more. But as we understand trauma, previously the focus was on, you know, how horrific was the event that you experienced. And if it was horrific enough, then, you know, we can label that trauma. What we're recognizing now is that, you know, trauma isn't the result of the event itself, but it's a mismatch between our internal and external resources and the demand placed on our system. And so something that could, you know, maybe appear to be relatively minor from a healthy and safe perspective, if a person has very limited resources, that can be overwhelming to the nervous system. And especially when it comes to religious trauma, there's a lot of, you know, experiences that happen over a longer period of time, like complex trauma, developmental trauma. We're not usually talking about single incident shock trauma, but we're talking about, I don't trust myself, or I have to please and appease in order to survive. And that goes on for longer periods of time. And that can certainly, you know, take a toll on the nervous system and result in trauma.
One of the examples that I read through, I don't know where I found it, probably social media or on your website, which resonates so strongly with me and with the people that I interviewed, is that deep hardwired fear related to hell and how we stop believing in hell long kind of before our body stops, you know, like reacting to that. And so I know that you talk about that, like it's you when you talked about overwhelm, that's part of that overwhelm on the system, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
And would you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, for sure. You know, a common response to hell, you know, when folks deconstruct that belief, you know, they read all the books and study that, and they may come to a place, as I did, where I no longer believed in hell. And yet my body didn't read those same books. my right. body didn't have that same understanding. And frankly, our nervous systems don't care what our mind knows about that. Our bodies just want to feel safe. And so we think about when we encountered the doctrine of this belief in hell, it wasn't just a book we were reading. It wasn't just a story that we were hearing. We were having a physiological response to that. And often we think about how trauma functions. When we first encounter that, we may have had a startle or a shock response. And then our body begins to mobilize into a fight or flight response. I need to escape this threat. This isn't safe for me. And if you're in a church service or your family's around you, or it's this kind of like you're part of this community, you can't escape it, then your nervous system does the next best thing to survive, which is typically, you know, please and appease or freeze collapse response. And so at which point we feel very powerless or kind of overwhelmed. We're not able to do what we need to do you know, fend off the threat or escape to safety. And so even after we no longer believe in hell or we've escaped that context, we still carry that unresolved trauma response in our bodies. And we want to have some completion to that. And so we can be living with a mind that no longer believes in hell, and yet our body's still quite terrified by that idea when it shows up. And so that's why kind of working with trauma from a more embodied perspective is essential in my perception at least, in order to feel safe again. We need to do something now that undermines that previous experience, or to do now what we wish we could have done then.
That was so helpful whenever I was checking that out in your stuff. The other thing is, and I know that this one hit a nerve for so many people, your Facebook post about trauma not being people's fault. This was so big. And I am guilty of saying this. Trauma is not my fault, but the responsibility for healing is. Like, I say that to myself. I've said that to myself. I've said that to a few other people. And my God, this post was like spot on. So I just want to hit a couple of the highlights from your trauma is not your fault, period post. That it's about the language, and it's about not putting that weight on people, well-intentioned people, myself included, not putting that individual responsibility. I would love the way you said it, individual responsibility for a process that is rarely possible on one's own. And you also said that that kind of pressure can actually flip. And instead of it being empowering, it becomes disempowering and makes people feel isolated, and it makes us feel like it's like we are failing if we are not, you know, able to just get over it. So I don't know. This is so great. And the other point you made, which I think is so great in that same post, and we will put a link to this post in our show notes, but is that we don't heal alone, and that we have to be able to kind of co-regulate with other people for that healing to happen. So all of these things, oh my goodness, they just so deeply resonated. You can talk about any or all of that. That co-regulate piece too. I mean, would you just explain what co-regulate means? I think people hear that a lot, but like just in regular people speak, what does that mean?
Yeah, for sure. You know, we're social mammals. We evolved in community, and we show up as humans to the world with, you know, nervous systems that aren't anywhere close to being fully formed. And our ability to regulate our nervous systems require caregivers in those early years. And that persists throughout our lives as well. You know, if you're around someone who's feeling really anxious or nervous, you might find yourself kind of feeling a bit tense and on edge as well. Or if someone's, you know, really angry, you're going to, you know, have a reaction or response to that. And so co-regulating is often talked about in the positive sense of, you know, if you're around a calming, soothing person that can help your nervous system to be, you know, kind of more kind of calm as well. But really, it goes both ways. We can upregulate and downregulate by another person's nervous system. And so just recognizing that, especially trauma that's kind of interpersonal in nature or that happens within community, you know, when we've been harmed in those relationships, we need relationships to heal that. And as much as I had bought into the whole American ideal of the rugged individual, and I think that can feel empowering as a concept, the reality is that we don't heal alone. We do need each other. And, you know, even if we do some work alone, our nervous system doesn't quite trust that until it's tried out in relationships. And so, the need to be in relationship with others to have that supportive, caring other to navigate those experiences in community, is so important.
That sounds good. And I think about all of the people in my own path that helped me to do that work. And sometimes it was therapists, and sometimes it was clergy people, and sometimes it was friends. I just loved that. And that, that period on the end of that statement was so lovely.
Yeah. That particular post really surprised me. I think I shared after that post, a few posts later, that you know, I was just lying in bed one night and came across this. It's a common phrase, you know, trauma's not your fault, but healing's your responsibility. And someone, the latest person, had written a blog about it, and it was kind of going all over social media. And I just realized how dismissive it was.
Yeah.
Well intentioned, but dismissive of survivors' experiences. And so I just jotted down some notes on the notes folder of my phone. And the next morning I was like, yeah, maybe I'll share this. I'm not sure if I'll share this. Okay, I'll share it. And so I put it out there, and in that post has, as of recently, last time I looked on Facebook alone, has reached over 4 million folks have seen that post. And then it was republished on several other news outlets and other sites. And so I know it's just really kind of gone viral to a limited extent. And the most common response that I get from that is, you know, finally someone's saying this.
Thank you. I felt this for so long.
I didn't have the words to say this. Or, you know, I was afraid to say it because as soon as I say, trauma's not my fault, period, people will be like, well, but you should try harder. You need to heal, or you can't, you know.
Pray harder. And one of the things that you do so wonderfully is hit those points that other people don't quite hit in the same way. The way I kind of describe it in my head is it feels very grounded in people's experiences, probably because you're working with people who are trying to heal. But another one that just resonated so deeply because I heard this again recently is that whole you should forgive, right? Just forgive, just forgive without like any accountability from, you know, the people who hurt you. That is like, that's like to put that on the victim is quite common.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think that I did a series of posts a few years ago that forgiveness is not required for healing trauma. And in fact, it can have the opposite effect for us. And then, you know, there's a really fascinating book by Michael McCullough. He I think it's called The Forgiveness Instinct. And yeah, a super, super great evolutionary kind of dive into where forgiveness comes from and how it evolved. And I grew up believing that forgiveness came from, you know, kind of religious traditions. And in fact, we're just one of many mammals who have forgiveness as part of our repertoire for kind of social relationships. And so he highlights these conditions that are required for forgiveness to make sense. And if there is no change in on behalf of the perpetrator, it's such that they won't harm us again, forgiveness doesn't make sense. In fact, it can keep us being re-traumatized or harmed by the individual. And so instead of we need to put pressure on folks to forgive, we should, you know, focus that energy more on what can we do as a community to hold people accountable so that forgiveness can be possible. And I think that, you know, you often hear these amazing stories of forgiveness. You know, someone harmed a family member and the family has come to a place where they can forgive that person. And we kind of hold that up on a pedestal and look how amazing the human spirit is that they can forgive. I think when that is healthy and okay for folks, it's usually these other conditions are being met, you know, like there's no intention of harming you again. There's some advantage to forgiving them. And so I think just looking at it through that lens of how does forgiveness actually function as opposed to just kind of universally kind of pressuring folks to forgive is so helpful. Yeah.
I think that pressure just makes the system feel good, but not the poor person who's, This is another thing that you really helped provide another kind of perspective for me, because in my own research about, you know, religious abuse, even in my parlance in, you know, my college, it was religious miseducation. Mm-hmm. Everybody that I spoke with, including my own experiences, raised the issue of hypocrisy. Like, it's so big. And it was one of the biggest, you know, kind of turnoffs to religion, or one of the biggest kind of like motivators to get out of that and into something else. But you wrote that we shouldn't focus on hypocrisy, that it's really about the power and control that exists within the structure, which I flipping love. I just think that to not have our attention on, like, it's like almost that shiny object, like, look over here, look over here, so we don't see all of this other stuff that's supporting that thing. So yeah, that's just another thing that one of these insights that pops up on in your work that as a survivor I love. So is that, do you write about that because in your own practice and maybe in your own experience, that was a thing that kept coming up?
Yeah, for sure. I think what often happens when we are raised or spend a lot of time inside of a fundamentalist kind of context, the focus is really about, you know, the beliefs, the ideas. We're kind of really living in our minds. And so it's easy for us to see, like, well, what is adding up and what's not adding up? What's right? What's wrong? And so, you know, the pastor who's, you know, caught doing the thing that he's been preaching against. You're like, it's so, like you said, it's a shiny object. It's so easy to see. And we can really kind of focus on that. Not that it's not helpful to focus on that and that we shouldn't kind of address that. But if we see what usually happens in those situations, well, the pastor's like, well, I didn't live up to my ideals and I'm really sorry and I'm going to do better now. And so it's like the main offense was, you know, I was a hypocrite, as opposed to here's how I harmed others. And here's the system and the structure that allowed me to harm others. And here's the forgiveness that sweeps in, allows me to kind of continue to harm others. And I don't have to take responsibility and accountability. And so kind of shifting away from, am I believing the right things? Am I saying the right things? To like, how are these behaviors functioning in the world? And are they helpful or harmful to others? And so, yeah, I think it's very common for us to, you know, look at the hypocrisy, because like you said, it's so obvious to us. You know, we also want to include, what are those power structures that are allowing this to persist, and how is that functioning in that community?
Yeah, because the power structure also is the family power structure. The church or the religious power structure is reflected in the family power structure. So those hypocrisies can show up in lots of different ways. I think about how in the 80s, that's when boys first started piercing their ears. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have my ears pierced. I could not, because, you know, if God wanted holes in your ears, he would have put them there. That's what I used to be told. But my brothers could have their ears pierced because they were men and they can make decisions for themselves. I was not. Yeah. And I'm like, no, that's just such a minor, you know, example of hypocrisy. But when those kinds of examples get played out over and over and over, it just adds up to a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, even as you're describing that, notice how you pointed out the power structure differential there, right? And how, you know, boys get to make choices for themselves, for their own bodies, and girls, men get to make choices for them. And so we can say, well, that seems hypocritical, the like, can I get earrings or not? But underneath that is this power structure that you don't get to make choices
control
for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yes. Yes. Thank you for raising those kinds of things in your work.
Brian, you wrote you were taught about love by people who espouse hate and that it's disorienting. Mm. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. I think if you were to check the date on that post, that would have been during our former president's reign in our country. And I think a lot of folks who were leaving evangelicalism since 2016 were seeing family members, loved ones, kind of jumping on this bandwagon of hate and you know, dehumanizing others. And to see that, it was very disorienting for many of us. You know, we're taught, you know, maybe these Christian ideas of love, but then we see how it's actually played out in the world. And it
was taking
form of hate for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of brings up an interesting thing that I've observed over time as well, how values function inside of a lot of religious communities, not as values that we kind of embody and feel connected to, but more as rules. And so, yeah, so there, it's easy to say that we value love and acceptance. But when that just becomes a rule of you have to be like us or believe like us in order to be accepted, yeah, it just has a very different function. And so, yeah, I think a lot of folks saw during that time and continue to see, as Robin pointed out, how are these Christians making sense of their dehumanizing others and squaring that with their kind of religious faith? Yeah, it's very disorienting.
I've heard explanations, but I still don't like them. And I'm trying to watch the time. I want to switch gears a little bit.
I'm watching.
Oh, you're so, see, she's usually
go ahead.
Okay. Well, I will say, I really want to talk about what you do to help people resolve these issues. So I think, Big, this might have been on your list, but I'd like to ask it if you don't mind. So you use the terms deconstruction and deconversion. Thank you for giving me that second word, because I was sort of lumping everything into deconstruction. What is the difference between the two, and does it matter in terms of people's healing?
Yeah. So if I'm to be completely honest with you, I don't like either of those terms.
Okay. Tell us. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And I think the reason for that is I've not found a term that really captures that experience that also kind of lines up with what we know about how our brains function and how our brains work. We can't unlearn something. We don't have an eraser. Our brain doesn't have an eraser. And so this idea of deconstructing or deconverting or unlearning just doesn't square with what we know about neuroscience. And so I use those terms because that's what's kind of widely used. And I appreciate them. You know, the deconstruction comes from, I think, philosophy and, you know, I think comparative literature, like deconstructing text, you know, breaking down into the composite pieces and rethinking it and reworking it. If we think of that process not as a subtractive process, but as an additive process, you know, I'm having a new understanding or a new awareness, and I'm applying it to these old things. That to me makes more sense in terms of how our brains actually work. And so if I think about my quote unquote deconstruction, it was when I discovered that, you know, people who didn't believe the same things I believed were moral human beings. That's new information. And now I need to find out, how do I square that with what I know, what I knew then, and what do I know now? And so I appreciate that those terms exist and they're helpful. People can identify with them. But for me, they don't quite fit. And so the difference, as I think of between deconversion and deconstruction often is about, you know, kind of what are my doctrines and what are my beliefs now? And, you know, does it still fit or not? And I'm kind of picking apart these beliefs, these ideas. Deconversion is certainly not a term that I came up with, but folks were using that as a way of describing, you know, kind of leaving a religious community, deconverting. You know, there's the emphasis on converting to religion, and then deconversion is a way of kind of conceptualizing what it's like to kind of leave that. That also falls short for a lot of us who were, you know, born and raised, as it were, inside of a religion. We may have had a quote unquote conversion experience, but we really didn't have much choice in that. Mm-hmm, you know, it was expected and part of that. And so, you know, if we didn't convert, you know, at least not with any kind of autonomy or consent, then, you know, deconversion doesn't really make as much sense as the opposite of that. And so, yeah, I think all these terms kind of fall short to some degree, but also are helpful in creating a structure or an idea. But yeah, thinking about what am I learning now? And how is this new understanding, how does that change my relationship to the old kind of content that I've encountered in the past? For me, that feels a bit more empowering than I need to tear all the old stuff down before I move forward. Yeah, it's often both, you know, it's kind of happening at the same time. I'm, you know, tearing down the old stuff, as it were, as I'm encountering new information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and things like, because I use that too, I love the thought of tearing down. But then as you're saying that, I'm thinking, yes, but I'm replacing that with new things.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's so helpful. I was thinking of the word transmute too, when you said the others don't quite work. And I don't know if transmute is it either, but at least transmuting is not, you know, not expecting your brain to sort of just disappear it. Mm-hmm. It's like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I struggle with there is, what's the point of reference, right? If I'm deconstructing, you know, the point of reference is still those original religious beliefs.
Right. Yep.
And it's like I connecting to my humanity, you know, having that kind of be more central, or the point of reference, then how do I want to be human? And what are my internal values? What do I care about? Who do I want to be in the world? And then I can notice how my religious beliefs maybe are getting in the way of me being fully human. And it's not necessarily deconstructing as much as it's embracing one's own humanity.
I have a quick follow-up to that. So the other thing is that you talk about how it's not necessary to like fully, I'm not sure what the right language is here, but like you don't have to live in that past trauma to do the healing work. And I always thought you had to sort of process quite a bit of that past trauma before you could get to the healing work. And maybe, am I fairly representing that? And would you speak a little bit to that? Because
for sure. Yeah, I think, again, as we are learning more about how trauma works and, you know, different approaches to healing, there used to be a focus on we need to dive deep into the past and what was the root of the trauma and kind of relive or re-experience that in order to heal. And thankfully, our nervous systems don't require us to do that. That can be helpful and effective. It can also be re-traumatizing for a lot of folks. You know, if you were to show up in my office and say, you know, I've had this significant trauma in my childhood, and you just kind of launch into that without enough of a container of safety and support, that's going to be overwhelming to a nervous system and can be re-traumatizing. If I were to say, well, let's do some work together and, you know, tell me more, tell me the details. Let's go back. Where did this begin? Where did this start? Again, if we're going at that as like, I need to get to the core of this or the heart of this in order to heal, you may have a big sense of release, right? There might be some catharsis that happens, but that often is destabilizing to the nervous system as well. And so what we need now, we need to be able to do now what we wish we could have done then, something that resolves that trauma, something that communicates to my nervous system, you know, speaking of the idea of hell, I can get up and walk out of the church. I know what it feels like to have done that. Maybe all the boundaries that were violated inside of a religious community, maybe instead of like, I need to get to the heart of those and relive or re-experience those, I can set some boundaries in my employment. I can set some boundaries with my friends. And now that's giving my nervous system some actual data of like, I can do what's necessary to defend and protect myself. And that's incredibly healing. And so we can heal by moving back in the past, and we can heal by what do we need to do now. I'm not saying that one way is the right way or the best way, but to let folks know that we don't have to always dig. And that's really helpful, especially when some of the trauma that we've experienced have been in pre-verbal states, right?
Yes.
The early childhood trauma that happened before we had language or memories, that our brains weren't encoding that so we can access that. You know, a lot of folks experienced a lot of healing with no sense of what happened to them, but they knew what happened wasn't okay for their nervous system. And so, yeah, working more directly with the body tends to be a helpful way of processing through that trauma without it being, without as much risk for it being re-traumatizing for folks.
And that's where the emphasis on safety comes in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You were going to ask that, weren't you, Big? I see you shaking your head. No, because you emphasize the importance of safety, and it's like, you might know that you're safe, but feeling that you're safe, those are two different things. And that was my own experience, knowing it
for
and
sure.
feeling it and believing it, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah. I think Stephen Porges says that as concisely as I've heard it, the removal of threat is not the same thing as the experience of safety. And I think folks who, applying this to kind of religious trauma, folks who have exited or escaped a harmful context or environment, we don't feel safe yet, right? You know, folks who, you know, you can, if you could kind of magically transport yourself to a safe setting, your nervous system is still waiting for the next shoe to drop. It can't trust that. I'm not sure that I'm safe yet. And so we want to really focus on what are these experiences of safety, which tend to be experiences where in which we feel empowered and strong, and we can move more freely. And so, yeah, you know, to leave a harmful context is not the same thing as experiencing safety. And so, yeah, really focusing on how can we resource the nervous system to begin to feel safe again.
And that is a process.
It is. Yeah.
So this is what I just want you to be able to speak a little bit about your Room to Thrive. What is it that you offer? I just want to be able to let people hear about what you have available, because it's flipping awesome. I mean, just going to the website is flipping awesome. But yeah, would you just plug a little bit your services?
Okay, for sure. Yeah. So Room to Thrive is my private practice here in Boise, Idaho. And I'm licensed in the state of Idaho. I can work with folks doing this kind of deeper trauma work that we've been talking about for folks who are physically in Idaho. I also provide trauma-informed coaching that's more proactive, forward-focused, that tends to be for folks who are in the middle of deconstructing their faith and looking for additional resources to understand that, and or folks who may be working with a therapist who understands trauma but doesn't really understand religious trauma. And so kind of bridging that kind of knowledge gap there. In addition to Room to Thrive and the work that I'm doing there, I'm one of the founders of the Religious Trauma Institute, and we're providing clinical trainings for therapists, as well as consultation groups and additional resources for survivors there as well. Our focus with the Religious Trauma Institute is primarily on helping the helpers so they can provide better service to survivors. And so, yeah, that's definitely another area that I'm involved in.
Well, and there's one of the things that I appreciated on your website, you have links to other states, or maybe that's through the collective, I'm not sure, of therapists with religious trauma training, right?
Sure.
So, yeah. So anyway, it's very, very good. Go check it out. We'll, of course, have it linked in our show notes. And now we'll get to the final questions, which we love to ask all of our guests. And you have been wonderful. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Big, do you want to go first?
We have two. We'll see how this goes. What is your favorite spiritual practice? We're keeping an ongoing list. For some people, it's walking or just thinking, or for me, it's yoga. What's yours?
Yeah. So I have a complicated relationship with the term spiritual. I will acknowledge that. And actually, I wrote a blog post on this a few years ago. I was doing a clinical training, and they're talking about how to incorporate spiritual practices into kind of your practice. And what I've encountered is there are a lot of folks who come from religious backgrounds for whom spiritual kind of denotes supernatural or, extra human kind of experiences. And that word can be kind of challenging for them. I don't have, a big issue with the term spiritual, because I think it can be helpful as a concept. But I think too often it becomes a concept that's not aware that it's a social construct, but it becomes more of this kind of overarching umbrella that we need to fit everything inside of. And so, but I understand the heart of the question. What are these spiritual practices?
What is the practice that is meaningful to you?
Yeah. So certainly, I find a lot of meaning and purpose in connecting with nature. And so I spend a lot of time kind of in the outdoors. In the wintertime, it's skiing on the mountain. It's walking along the river. It's spending time with my kids in nature. So yeah, and that tends to be more than just like, oh, it's nice outside, but it's more of a just really soaking in and connecting to the trees and the animals and nature. So yeah, definitely that's for me is a very restorative kind of practice for myself.
That sounds good. And the other one is a little bit related, but do you have any sort of a role model or superhero for that practice?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I was trying not to say spiritual superhero.
No, it's okay. No, you can. And spiritual is perfectly okay. It's a lovely concept. It really is.
Yeah. I did read that blog post. And if we had more time, I was going to have you talk about that because it's so interesting. Sure. But we'll save that for another conversation.
Okay.
But perfect. Yes, yeah. if you have a spiritual superhero or role model.
Yeah. So I guess, after leaving kind of religious communities where folks have been put on pedestals, I don't know that I have anyone that I would want to put on a pedestal because I don't want to be put on a pedestal. And so, but I think that there are some lovely friends who I have who, when I'm with them, there's just a sense of presence and connection. Kind of any human that I encounter who there's a sense of they know who they are and they feel connected to themselves, I really admire that for sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
And on that lovely note, even though we could go on, we have to end this episode now, Brian. Thank you so, so much for being with us. It was delightful.
Oh, thank you, Deborah.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.